believe this program can work for me too. And with that, Jerry is going to come up and introduce our speaker tonight.
Hey everybody, I'm Jerry Melcock. I had a little bit less than a year a while ago, and I was trying to get my thoughts together and get composed and try to figure out what was going on. And at the end of this meeting, this girl comes up and they go to pick up chips, and she was sitting in the same row. And I looked at her like, well, she's got like maybe 60 days or something or whatever. And she picked up 13 years. And I was devastated. And then I'm like, how young was she? She got like sober before she started drinking, it seemed like. How did you pick up 13 years? I don't even have a year left. I'm this old guy and she's just young. And then through the years, I've gotten to know Katie. Everywhere you go, that there's some kind of something important or some message being carried or some work being done, you can count on Katie either being there or contributing. And we were very glad that we asked her to speak tonight, and we were glad she accepted. And I think you're in for a real treat. And I'll give you Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. So since you kind of, I'm really glad to be here, by the way. I mean, anytime I'm asked to come and speak, I think it's an honor. Some housekeeping since you brought it up is that I sobered up when I was 17, almost 18 years old. And so my sobriety date is May the 15th of 1989. And my home group is, I can just hear the thoughts in this room, like, God, I wasn't even born yet. Because that's what I used to think when I was 17, 18, 19 years old and sitting in this room, people would say things like that. I'd be like, God, you picked up that chip? I totally wasn't even born yet when you got sober. Now it's the most obnoxious thing I can possibly hear ever, just so you know. You know what, I came in young, and what's really awesome about that is I have been blessed with an adulthood of sobriety and a way to live that has turned out to be pretty freaking useful, I must say. But as far as my story goes, I'll just start at the beginning and go from there, because I always get nervous, so as soon as I, like, jump in, then, like, we're good. God takes over somewhere. Thank God. But anyway, I was born in New York City when I was young, obviously, when I was young. I was born in New York and lived there for like most of my early childhood. And my parents divorced when I was pretty young, like probably like 5 or 6 years old. And my dad moved down here to Georgia, to Clayton County. And so I kind of grew up split between New York City and Georgia, which is kind of odd, little parallel universes that I went back and forth. And I was kind of a weird kid. I was one of those like ADD, hyper, spaz, like, Ritalin wasn't really all that popular then, but I mean, had it been, I probably would have been on it, because my mom just has, like, countless stories of, like, you know, anytime she, like, turned her back, or, like, just for a second, I'd be, like, over here, over there, and just always into something, always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. Like, she has a great story about, like, being in Times Square with, like, all the kids when I was little, and she said I was probably like about 3 years old, and she said she just turned around for like a second and like I was gone. And Times Square is like really touristy, like steroids Vegas Disney now, but back then it was really sleazy and really gross. And she turned around for a second, and then she was like, I was gone, and I disappeared in Times Square. And she's like, oh my God, like freaking out, like, where am I? And then she said, like, a few minutes later, all of a sudden she hears this gruff, like, get out of here, kid. And I had, like, wandered into a porn shop or something, which is, I guess, probably really bad for business in a porn shop. Like, you need to get out of here. I mean, that's the kind of kid I was. And really, I think I was an alcoholic long before I ever picked up a drink. I mean, I feel like there was just always something that was not quite right with me. I never quite fit. I always, you know what, And I came into AA, and it was the first time I really heard people talk like that. And that was, like, one of those things that I just identified with right away. It was like, oh, my God, I never felt right. I never felt right until I kind of started drinking. And then, you know, we'll get to that. But anyway, so I had this kind of unusual childhood of back and forth. And I had older sisters. And I got into trouble a lot, you know. Another great story about doing the wrong thing at the wrong time that I always use as kind of an example of just what I was like is in about the third grade. I was going to school in Clayton County, Georgia, and our teacher was doing this weird little elephant walk thing, you know, like when you're in elementary school, they just do cute little things, and, you know, she was bent over, and she was swinging her arms, and, you know, going around a little circle, and showing us how to do this, and she walked by, and all of a sudden, I just, like, smacked her on the ass. I didn't really think about it. I guess I kind of thought it would be funny, and it wasn't like I really processed it. I just kind of did it, and it was just awkward for all concerned. I mean, like, she just turned around, and, like, all the other kids just kind of turned around, and I got this, like, deer in headlights look, like, what? She didn't even know what to say, and then she kind of collected herself, and she, you know, pulled me outside and just kind of gave me, like, you just don't do that. You know, that's just not appropriate or whatever. I don't know. It wasn't even like I was in trouble. She was just like, that was weird. So I tell that story because it's funny, but you just have to know that, like, my childhood is filled with lots of weird, awkward moments like that where people were just like, really? Like, what did you just do? What did you just say? What? So anyway, I think by the time I was ready for a drink, I was really, really ready for a drink. Leading up to that, I had moved back to New York City when I was in fifth and sixth grade. And in fifth and sixth grade, my mom had married my stepdad, and, like, financially they were doing really well. And we lived in Brooklyn Heights, and I went to this great little private school in Brooklyn Heights. It was really cute, Quaker school. And it was a prep school, and a lot of the kids that I went to school with then, you know, like, went on to, like, you know, Harvard and Yale and Stanford and, like, all these great schools. And so the kind of conversations in fifth and sixth grade that I would have with these kids, you know, was, you know, about what all the great schools were and, like, you know, lawyers or doctors, like, who makes the most money and what do you do, you know, like, it was all that kind of talk. And then our stocks dropped, and, like, we had to move back to Manhattan, where I lived before, on the Upper West Side. So we had to move back to Manhattan, and I had to go to public school. So I had to leave my nice, cushy little private school and go to a public school in Manhattan where I was, like, the only white girl in the whole school, which is an interesting experience in New York because it doesn't, like, everybody else is, like, everything, like, black and Puerto Rican and Asian and everything, but I was, like, the one lone white girl. Like, hey, how you doing? So a little awkward, and I think I handled it in this really reasonable way by, like, you know, suddenly I was speaking half Spanish and half English and acting like a Puerto Rican, which seemed, once again, totally normal, right? And that was how I handled that. Now, what was really interesting, now funny in hindsight, I guess, about that whole scenario, was I still had my friends in Brooklyn. So, like, all through the week, I would try to pretend, like, to be this tough little street kid, like, being a little Puerto Rican and speaking half Spanish and half English and acting all tough. And then, like, on the weekends, I was still hanging out with my prep school kids and being like, talking about colleges and whatever and being trendy and, like, shopping in the Village. And so not long before I had my first drink, I remember this one really, really awkward moment that never actually happened, but there was going to be an event. There was going to be an event where my best friend from the public school and my best friend from the private school were actually going to be in the same place at the same time. And what I remember was just this horrific, gut-wrenching fear of, oh my God, who am I going to be? Like, how am I going to do it? And the event never happened, and thank God it never happened. But what I remember is that fear. I just remember that awful fear of, I'm going to be found out. You know, I can't be everything to everybody all at the same time. And so when I was 12 was when I had my first drink, and it wasn't really, really dramatic. It was a New Year's Eve, and my grandparents were in town, and my family was just doing, like, a at-home New Year's Eve celebration. And we had champagne. And I had sips of alcohol before, you know, like I'd had like a sip of wine or a sip of beer or something. I don't know. I'd had little sips of stuff, but I had never made it past the first sip because, you know, the first sip was always just like, you know, and I just couldn't get past it. So champagne was the first time. And they said, you know, oh, you want a glass of champagne? Oh, cute. All right. I had a glass of champagne, and it was the first time that I kind of liked it. And I was like, this tastes okay. I can totally rock this. And so I had, you know, one flute glass, and then I had three or four more flute glasses. No, four. I think I had a total of four flute glasses. So, as quick as I could, and then we were out, right? And I was, like, tipsy and drunk, and it was, but, you know, but not crazy, you know, and it was kind of, you know, my grandparents thought it was cute, because I was kind of, like, you know, teetering around a little bit, and they were like, oh, it's cute, she's kind of drunk, da, da. So, and I remember it was fun. I remember I liked the feeling very much. But what I mean by, like, it wasn't dramatic was it wasn't like, oh, and now I feel like I have to do this forever, you know, or I have to wake up and drink again, or I don't know, whatever all those things are that I thought if you were an alcoholic, you know, you would have this immediate crazy reaction. But here's what I do remember is I remember that I wasn't finished. I drank 4 flute glasses because when I had that 4th flute glass, that was all we had. Like, neither one of my parents are big drinkers. Like, I have plenty of alcoholism in my family, but it's all real peripheral. Neither one of my parents are big drinkers, so they had like 2 bottles for the whole family. For 4 adults and 3 kids, they had 2 bottles. So what I remember is from the very beginning, after I had that first drink, I wanted more. That I had that craving, that physical craving from the very beginning. And my drinking continued on from there, and not like, ooh, and I started drinking all the time right away. But when I drank, every single time that I drank, and it's not like I noticed this until after I got sober, because, you know, of course, at the time, it all seemed very normal. But when I drank, unless somebody told me we had to go home and was dragging me away, which I was young, so that happened a lot, right? Or we ran out. I was young and poor, so that happened a lot. But if we didn't run out and nobody told me to go home, I drank to blackout every single time. That was the kind of drinker that I was. There was no real part of me that was like, wanted to drink like a normal person from the get-go. Like, I know plenty, it's really funny because I was talking to this guy who I work with, actually, who's like, thinks he's an alcoholic, showing some signs. We'll save a seat for him. And he was actually asking me about it. And it's so funny to me sometimes, like, what I think of as grown-up alcoholics, like these people who actually, like, drank normally for kind of a period of time and then, like, pushed over the edge, you know, and started drinking, like, unmanageably. Like, those people I don't understand because, really, from the beginning, I was like, that was how I drank. I'm in. Like, and also every now and then, you know, I watch other people who sobered up young, you know, and you guys might get this, but, you know, like, I've watched other people, like, struggle with, you know, I don't know, maybe it was just a party phase, maybe I could drink normally now. And trust me, I mean, like, I've wondered that stuff, and I've been like, well, I don't know. But here's what gets me every single time that I go there is I go, there is no part of me that wants to go to a ball game and drink a beer. That sounds so uncomfortable to me. That sounds more uncomfortable than drinking a Coke every day of the week. Like, no part of me that goes, I'm going to have a beer. And that's it. No, like, the only thing I ever, like, thought, like, maybe I could do that, or the only thing that I ever, like, when I'm, like, off or, you know, not spiritually right, or times when I've been, like, not okay sober, is I look at people who can get really, really drunk and then somehow keep their lives together. I don't know how they do it. They blow my mind. Like, those really heavy drinkers that can, like, go, woo, and, like, totally party, get completely smashed, and then somehow get up and go to work the next day. I never understood these people. I was never one of these people. But that's who I wanted to be. I could never be that person. So that started when I was 12, and then it really was like, it wasn't like I boom started drinking right away, but something happened, man. Like, there was a flip that was switched that I loved. I loved everything about drinking, about getting loaded, and about people that did that, you know? And I discovered other substances, too, that I thought were lots of fun. And it was like an after-school special, you know? Like, I remember, you know, that just opened up these weird doors. Like, I was finally in on something, you know? Like, really, that uncomfortable, awkward girl with, like, braces and no boobs and bad hair. It was like I finally felt like I was in on something. You know, because I had, you know, guys who, like, didn't even show up to class were, like, coming up and being like, dude, you know, you got the white girl high, like, right on. You know, like, it was like I was in on, like, this big joke that I'd never been in on before. And I loved it. And I was in. And all of a sudden, really, my grades plummeted. You know, cutting school was awesome, great, you know, and it was, in New York City, it was really easy. God, it was so easy in New York City, because we got to go out for lunch, and then you came back for, like, the second half of school, so, like, we would go out for lunch, and then why would you want to come back, you know, especially if it's nice outside, a day like this. Central Park is awesome, and it's right there. Why would you want to go back to school? And our school, and that school had, like, so much other stuff to worry about that nobody was, like, calling your parents if you didn't come. So, you know, all of a sudden grades are plummeting, and my mom is having all kinds of problems with me. I'm stealing from her. I'm lying. I'm just out of control already. Then somewhere in there, my mom decides that she's going to take a job, and she's going to teach at a university and is moving us to Granville, Ohio. So before I start high school, I'm going to move from Manhattan to Granville, Ohio. totally awesome. Yeah, so population 5,000, right? And the only saving grace of Granville, Ohio, is the fact that there is a university there. And it's not a big one. It's like 2,000 students or something like that. But it was once described in the Barron's Book of Colleges as the best academic party school in America. So in other words, it was like a really good school, like it was this liberal arts school, and it was kind of like all the kids from the Northeast who party just a little too much to get into the Ivy League schools, like all kind of defaulted into the safety school. Like that's really kind of what it was. So anyway, Denison was there, and that was the saving grace. But so we moved there, and it's like starting all over, right? And I'm sure some of you guys have had this before. So my mom's like, okay, now we're living in Ohio. You're going to like go to a normal high school with like a football team and things like that, because you just really didn't have that kind of stuff in New York. You know, it's going to be like, yeah, great, and by the way, you're pretty much going to start off grounded. We're not going to have any of that funny business like we had in New York, and you're going to go see a psychologist, and, you know, it was like all that kind of stuff. And so she was going to be real strict, and so I learned how to sneak out pretty quickly, and I learned how to just get around all of that kind of stuff. But there was a part of me that wanted to start over. I mean, I had already been to a lot of different schools, and I tell people sometimes, like, you know, I went to 9 schools in 12 years of high school, 12 years of school, I went to 9 schools, which sounds really, like, pitiful, like, oh, my God, you had to change schools that much, you know, part of it was divorce or whatever. Most of the time, I was ready to go. Like, most of the time, because of all that awkwardness and whatever, like, I had already created weird, awkward situations at one school, and it was like, oh, thank God I can go to another school because I can, like, start over. And then I would start over and create all the same weird, awkward crap and then have to start over again at the next school. So anyway, so there was a piece of like, okay, we're starting fresh, and okay, I had all that trouble last year, and now I'm going to do good, and I'm going to like make good grades. I really would. I would start off every quarter like, I'm totally going to do my homework this quarter. I'm going to bring home all my books. And I would. Almost every time I would bring home all my books and never open them. But I would. Every day I would leave school with like a full backpack, and I just wouldn't do it. So all the same stuff starts again. I'm sneaking out. I'm going to see some psychologist named Suzanne. And, like, really, for me, this was just a format for me to complain about my mom. Because my mom is what's really my problem. And she never asks me if I drink, like Suzanne. Never. I don't know why. I drew pictures of, like, my family and trees and other weird stuff. But she never did ask me if I drank. Which might have been key, but I don't know. So over the next couple of years, I mean, obviously what happens is it gets worse. You know, one of the things that I learned about alcoholism when I came here is that it always gets worse. And here's the thing, though. It doesn't ever feel like that's happening. It never feels like it's getting worse. It always kind of goes from, like, point A to point Q, and I don't know where all the other letters go, you know? And down here in the South, I learned, like, the weird phrase, the frog in the boiling pot. Has anybody else ever heard that phrase? Okay, good. Because seriously, you say that in some circles, and they're like, what are you talking about? Okay, but I'll explain for everybody else, right? Okay, so if you put a frog in boiling water, he'll be like, whoa, and hop out. Like, that's not cool. But if you put a frog in cold water and slowly turn up the heat, then the frog is dead before he realizes what happens. This is, like, my disease. Now, really, like, what kind of sicko is doing this experiment with frogs to pick out this kind of information? I don't know. But I get it. This is what my disease is like. Is my disease is totally like starting in cold water and slowly turning up the heat. Because who I am and who I wanted to be changed an awful lot. I mean, I didn't drink for that long. I mean, from the time I was 12 to the time I was almost 18, a good 5.5 years, right? Maybe 5 years, really. But at the beginning of that time, I mean, I was the kid who was still talking about, you know, going to prep schools. I was the kid who was talking about, you know, which colleges were the best ones and being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. And I was a smart kid, you know, that was not, like, out of my reach or anything. But, you know, there was a point in high school where it was like, well, you know, like, state schools are pretty cool. State schools are awesome, you know? And then it was like, well, you know, community college isn't so bad because then you can just kind of, like, dip your toes in. And then it was like, well, you know, you can just take a year off, you know, and, like, find yourself before you go to school. And, you know, and by the time I got here, you know, I was pretty much, I didn't have any classes at high school anymore, and we'll get there in a second. But, I mean, my big dream was, like, I could not wait till I turned 18 years old because I could get a job at this bar called The Point, Little Five Points, and, like, live in an apartment with 10 other people and, like, just stay loaded. Like, that was my big, that was my goal, man. That was awesome. That was who I wanted to be. I don't remember making those decisions, you know. Like, I don't remember going from here to here. I don't remember, like, this is really important and who I am is really important to, like, I don't care. I don't know when that happened. But it did. So anyway, so I'm in Ohio hanging out, screwing things up, you know, bad things happen, blah, blah, blah. So halfway through my junior year, my mom was actually being kind of cool, I think, at this point, because we had gone through contracts and this and that. She'd be more strict, she'd be less strict, whatever it was that she thought would work, none of it ever did. So anyway, I came back home from my curfew, and then I snuck back out to go to Denison, to go to the university. And then apparently, like, I didn't run out of alcohol, and nobody told me to go home, and I drank like I drank. And so what happened was I woke up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up to, like, an RA running down the hallway yelling, like, if anybody knows where Katie Thornberry is, tell her mom is looking for her. She needs to go home now. And my mom didn't know where I was. She was just, like, kind of putting out this, like, APB, like, my daughter is missing, and she was, you know, in bed the last time I knew at night. And so, you know, these guys are like, dude, you got to go home, you know, because it's bad, I guess, to have a 16-year-old, like, passed out on your floor in the dorm room. So on the five-minute walk home, I'm like, okay, well, I'll just, you know, I'll tell my mom that I got up and went to Saturday school, because, of course, I had Saturday school, because I'm sure I was in trouble for something, and I had missed it. And so I get home, and, you know, my mom is sitting down, and my stepdad's sitting down, and I'm like, hey, so I went to Saturday school, and I heard you were looking for me. I got up early and walked, and they were like, we already called Saturday school. And, you know, and she was like, sit down. She's like, you have two choices. You know, she's like, you can go and live independently, like, get out. Or I've spoken to your father in Atlanta, and he's willing to let you come and live with him if you would like to do that. And I was like, I'll go live with Dad. Because I didn't know anybody who lived on their own in Ohio. I mean, I knew people that lived with families, and I knew college students. So it wasn't like, yeah, I'm going to go live in with my buddy. No. So I was like, all right, I'll move down to Atlanta. So I came down to Atlanta, and I liked Atlanta anyway. And I had a lot of friends here. I came here for the summer. And you know, my dad and I sat down, and, you know, we had the, like, okay, we're not going to have any of this funny business, like, what's going on with your mom, you know? And I was, oh, of course not, Dad, of course not. So within a week, it was New Year's Eve, and it's New Year's Eve, and my dad was really nice. He would not let me spend the night with my friend, which, by the way, at this point, anytime I spent the night with a friend, it meant I was going to go somewhere, and I was going to drink until I passed out, and I didn't really care where I woke up, but I knew I had to, like, cover my bases. So he wouldn't let me spend the night out, which was weird, but he said I had to be home at 4 o'clock in the morning. Pretty generous, right, for, like, a 16-year-old. And so I was like, okay. So, of course I go out. Of course it's New Year's Eve. Of course I'm – and I tell him at my friend Sony's. Of course I'm not at my friend Sony's, which, by the way, Sony's house is, like, right down the street. It's really weird. Every time I pass it, I'm like – so I'm not at my friend Sony's, which is my alibi. I'm, like, out with this weird skinhead dude and his friend. And we start at one place, and then we end up at another, and I don't know. So, once again, I wake up. It's daylight. It's 10 in the morning. This time, I don't even know where I am. The guy's, like, next to me over here. I think the guy who drove us is in the other room. I don't know where. I don't know whose house this is. I don't know. I'm walking around going, like, oh, my God, like, where am I? I'm in so much trouble. And then in the other room, like, there's people I don't know. And then there's this coked-out girl, like, ah! She's, like, and I'm, like, really hungover. And she's, like, ah! I'm coked out. And I'm, like, oh, my God. I'm, like, do you have a phone? Because as I was noting with Jerry, like, he was saying something about drunk dialing. I was like, yeah, we didn't have cell phones when I was drinking. I know. Isn't that weird? Yeah. So anyway, I'm like, do you have a phone? I need to call my dad. So anyway, she gives me a phone, and I call my dad. And I'm like, cool, I'll just tell him I fell asleep at Sony's, right? So, you know, hey, Dad. Yeah, I fell asleep at Sony's. I already called Sony's. Where are you? And I was like, I wasn't prepared for that question. So I was like, oh, where am I? And she's like, ah! And, like, trying to explain to me where I am. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, I can't even hear her. And I'm like, hold on, Dad. So I put my dad on the phone with the coked-out girl so that she could give him directions. So I don't know. She gave him directions. They're like, eh, whatever. He understood her. And he's, I'll be right there. Okay. Great. So I'm like thinking, I'm so toast. Like, we've been talking military school and, like, all these other things. Like, I'm in so much trouble. So my dad comes to get me. I get in the car. We pull forward 6 feet. I have to throw up. It's bad. If I can, he doesn't even say it. He just says, you know, you're going to go to sleep, and we're going to talk when you wake up. So I go to sleep, talk when I wake up. And, you know, and then he gives me a long, long lecture, blah, 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 you know, because you can just, yeah, I don't know what he said, but, you know, I could endure it, blah, blah, blah. And the end result was, and you're grounded for a week. And I was like, okay. And then after I pouted for, like, 5 days, he finally let me go out with my brother. I mean, I was like, and I started to realize that my dad, at this point, was kind of guilt-ridden. Like, he had now been divorced twice, and he was single and on his own. And I think he felt really guilty. And what I honed in on was weakness. And I just went, wow. I mean, if I can leverage this the right way, I can pretty much do whatever I want. Now, was that a conscious thought that I had? No, but I figured out really quickly, like, I could get away with murder. And so I did. And the next, like, year and a half, I made my dad's life pretty miserable, you know. And at this point, I'm like, my hair's all black. I'm wearing all black. It's all shaved around the sides. Every one eye. I'm, like, hanging out in little Five Points because those are all my favorite people. And now I know people who live on their own. And now I actually, like, all my buddies are, like, these little street urchin runaways who live in little Five Points and, like, you know, shack up with each other. Like, this lifestyle I love. I think it's awesome. But now I can't be a dork and, like, run away from home when my dad lets me do pretty much whatever I want because that's not cool. And then all my friends who, like, actually had to leave home or got kicked out for some reason would be like, why would you leave home? You have food in the refrigerator, right? Doesn't make sense. So that's not cool. So I would try to get kicked out. I really would literally try. I would just try to, like, push. And once again, like, my dad was so easy, but now I had leverage. I wanted to be kicked out. I wanted to be able to go and, like, live with all of them. So I would try to get kicked out. So anytime my dad wouldn't let me do what I wanted, I would push as hard as I could because what was he going to do? Kick me out? Great. You know, so really made his life miserable that year. And he didn't kick me out, and I think he had an awful lot of heartache over it because, yeah. And he talked a lot. Later on, we've talked about that last year, and I think physically, mentally, spiritually, like, my dad just took it that year. I mean, it was a very, very rough year for him. And, of course, I was just completely oblivious, and I was just doing what I wanted to do. And you know what? If people let me do what I want, then we would all be okay. You know, none of my problem, it did not even remotely occur to me that I had a drinking problem. Not even close. Not even remotely. Never went like, maybe it's the drinking. You know, maybe that's the, it. No, it never was. If you would just let me do what I wanted to do, I would be fine. We would all be good. So I went to Towers High School for like a year where my dad lived, and then at the end of that year, or actually it was really only half a year because I started halfway through the year, they thought that I might feel more comfortable at Open Campus. So the next year I went to Open Campus, DeKalb, which I don't even know if it's there anymore, which is the kind of school where, like, you can set your own classes and, you know, nobody even calls your parents about anything. Your grades, your classes are all your responsibility, but there's natural consequences. So, you know, if you miss more than 3 full days of class, you just get dropped from the class, right? Natural consequences. So, in other words, before long, I didn't have classes anymore, you know, because I would go take a half or whatever, and, you know, after a while, I'm just pretending to go to school every day. Like, see you, Dad. I'm off to school. And I don't have any classes anymore. Somewhere in here, I, like, fell in love with a guy who was, you know, about as messed up as I was or then some. I thought maybe he was more. I don't know. Anyway. And it was all very dramatic, you know, as it can be. And that went on for a few months, and then he got put in treatment. And he got put in treatment for some notes that I wrote about some stuff that we were doing. He got thrown in treatment. And that was the first time I kind of looked at maybe staying sober. And I kind of went, maybe what we're doing is messed up. But it was really about him. You know, I was being, I needed to be supportive because I was very dramatic. Like, oh, you know, I'll stay sober for you. And that guy, because when you went to treatment back then, it's not like this anymore, I don't think. But I mean, like, you went for like 28 days. Like, that was how it went. Like, if you were an inpatient, you stayed. Like, insurance companies would let them keep you. They don't do that anymore. Not so much. But, so anyway, he was going to be gone for this long chunk of time, and I was like, oh, I'll stay sober for you, it'll be great. And then I kind of tried to stay sober, and then a few days later, I was like, well, if I get loaded and he doesn't know about it, then that's pretty much the same thing, because, you know, I'm still being supportive. So I'm getting loaded, I'm lying to him about it, and it's the first time I've kind of introduced to the 12-step world, but not a lot, because we go to those little family, you know, things and stuff where you visit, and... Anyway, he gets out, and he's going to go to meetings, and it was the first time I ever went to an AA meeting was after he got out, and it was in October of 1988, and we went to the Triangle Club, and the Triangle Club then was like kind of small little room, and it was smoky. It was like totally filled with smoke, and had coffee, and I thought it was awesome. Well, I thought it was awesome, but just because, you know, it was filled with smoke and coffee, and that was great. But we came like right at 8 o'clock and sat in the meeting. Like, they asked for newcomers. Like, I think it is so brave, by the way, when people ask, like, if it's your first AA meeting, people actually raise their hand. There was no way I was going to raise my hand at that meeting. There was no way. I wasn't going to pick up a white chip. I was going to do anything. Like, I was invisible. We just sat in the back. And I don't even remember that much about the meeting. I mean, I don't remember much about what they said or anything. But I thought they it had nothing to do with me. Everybody there was old. And by old, I mean, like, they were probably younger than I am now. But all I saw was, like, a sea of old people. Like, that was how I saw it. And it was really cute that all those old people had somewhere to go to talk about their alcoholism and that they got help there. I thought it was really cute. I did not dislike AA. I couldn't make a connection. It had nothing to do with me. It was a bunch of old people. And ironically, that was probably a pretty young meeting at the time, too. But it had nothing to do with me. And so... So I didn't do anything. And so the guy I was dating at the time, Tim, he went to outpatient, and continued to do some stuff. And then he had some issues. And so anyway, then his parents end up putting him in like this young people's program that was like north. I lived over like kind of Decatur area and he was going north. And so he kind of went away and like stayed up there for a while and did outpatient. And he was like 18. And this was still this period of time where I'm like kind of trying to stay sober. And what happens is I'll go, okay, I'm going to stay sober. And then I will change my mind. And then I'll go, okay, I'm going to stay sober. And then I'll change my mind. And I go back and forth. And the really important distinction to me was that I would always change my mind. I would not relapse, you know. It wasn't like I had to drink. It wasn't like I couldn't not control it. It was like I would just, it would suddenly would not make sense to me to not drink. So I would drink, you know. And what's really clear to me now is I really couldn't not drink. But at the time, the fact that I was changing my mind still made me feel like I had power, you know. And I really didn't. So still, I'm not thinking that I'm an alcoholic. But there's a point a few months in where he's out of his outpatient. He's going to move back with his parents. And he kind of has this talk with me, and it's like, and he's not, he wasn't willing to be direct enough to call me out on the fact that I was still drinking, even though I'm pretty sure he knew, and he wasn't going to say, if you don't sober up, I'm going to break up with you. So what he said was, you know, I'm going to be going to these meetings over on the north side of town, and if you don't start going to some meetings, then I probably won't see you very much, which I knew what he meant, you know, and I kind of knew what was up, and so I was like, well, I'll go to meetings. And I hadn't been to, you know, he was going to these young people's meetings, and I hadn't been to one of those. So I was like, I'll go, you know, cool, whatever. So I went, and, you know, and of course I lie. I get there, and, you know, and it's young people. So what was cool was it was faces I could, it was like somehow I could listen to you guys. I could listen to you guys in the way I couldn't listen to grown-ups, you know. And people are outside just smoking cigarettes and being all crazy and whatever. And, you know, and I just kind of go and I sit down and like, this kid sits next to me. And I just kind of do this, like, so what are you in for, you know, kind of talk. And you know, and he's telling me, like, what he did, you know. And he's kind of going down, like, you know, how he drank and what he was doing and that kind of stuff. And I'm listening to him being like, why is this kid here? This kid doesn't belong here. Like, I got loaded way more than this kid does. He totally doesn't belong here. You know, and of course the impact of that was lost on me at the moment, but I was like, all right. And then I sit in the meeting, and like I said, it was kind of like I could finally listen. And I think there was something in there that knew that I couldn't keep going the way that I was going, and I was going to have to try to do something different, you know. And it was probably really just because I might lose my boyfriend if I didn't do something different. I think that was a huge motivator. But it was like something cracked open, and I was just willing to listen. And it was good that I was, even although I lied, I told everybody, like, oh, yeah, I've already got, like, 4 months, you know, because I've been staying sober for him. I totally lied. But I started coming, and I was like, okay, I'll come. And it was fun. At least people did stuff. Like, because they would go out and do stuff, like, go have coffee till, like, you know, 1 million o'clock in the morning doing nothing. I don't know what we were doing, but it was hilarious, whatever it was. I mean, they would go out and have fun, and I needed that because there was no way in hell I was going to not drink and hang out with, like, you know, my same little street dirtbags who I love so much in Little Five Points. Like, that wasn't going to happen. I was not going to be able to, like, go to shows and, like, stay sober. So here was this whole little crew of people for me to hang out with, and that helped a lot. I was sober really by entertainment and curiosity for, like, the first little while. So, I mean, from that time that I went to that meeting, I stayed sober. And I finally got honest about the time that I had 30 days. Now, I didn't do anything, mind you. I just came. I came to meetings. I hung out with people. And I started to stay sober. I think people were like, get a sponsor. And I got one that I never called. I was like, okay, whatever. Well, actually, my first question was, can my boyfriend be my sponsor? And they were like, yeah, I wouldn't really recommend that. So I got some girl who I didn't call. And then the whole God thing, really not, I was not down for that. I fought that one tooth and nail. I thought that was really weird. And I thought we could just, actually, my other question was, can I be my own higher power? And keep coming back. But I was one of the people, I took pride in being like really vehemently like agnostic atheist. Actually, I had been atheist at one point, you know. I had to make myself theologically clear and delineated, whatever it was when I was drinking, you know, why, I don't know. But I had been atheist, and then I decided that atheist was just equally ignorant as believing, and that really what I was agnostic. And I loved, like, studying weird religions and pretending like I was really intellectual. But I liked pretending that I was really intellectual, and I would talk about, like, how they all just, like, completely conflict, and they're all just BS anyway. And, I loved arguing with Christians. I tried to argue with people when I got here, like, you know, sitting around at coffee, because I just, like, got off on that. I loved it. I loved, like, just picking battles with people. And it was really fun when you could get somebody to engage. And it wasn't fun at all here because nobody would engage. You know, everybody was just like, do whatever works for you, man. Okay, cool. You know, like, I got mine. Like, keep doing what you're doing. It's cool. But they just wouldn't. And they weren't even that snarky. They were just, like, with love, like, just wouldn't engage. Like, dude, it's cool. And thank God that they were, and thank God that they kept saying, you know what, it just whatever you want. You know, it doesn't have to be God, it doesn't have to be anything, just whatever you want. And I still fought it tooth and nail. So I hung around, and like I said, was sober by entertainment. I did get honest when I had about 30 real days, I started getting that, like, icky feeling, like that, like, God, I'm just lying, and everybody, you know, and, like, people were so nice and, like, reached out to me a lot, and I felt like a jerk. And so it was my first big, like, I'm going to walk through this scary thing because now I have to tell all these people, like, oh, by the way, I don't already have 4 months sober, which I thought was a big deal. They already pretty much knew that, I think. Yeah, they did. But, you know, it was good because it was that first, you know, like, I think we all have, like, that first thing that we're really scared to get honest about. And maybe for some people that happens in their inventory or, you know, it could be some other big thing. But for me, that was my first, like, oh, my God, I think he might all hate me and tell me to go away when you know this. And, you know, but I had to say it. I finally got to the point where it was so uncomfortable. And, you know, and I remember saying it, and people were like, dude, it's cool. Like, we all know. We've all done it. We've all, you know, we've all lied. It's cool. I'm just glad you're here, and I'm glad that you're going to feel a hell of a lot better now that you've said that. You know, and that was cool. And then even though I was sober by entertainment, I started to get little shots of things. Like, somebody said, you should read We Agnostics. It was really funny. The first chapter I ever read in the big book was We Agnostics. I didn't start anywhere else because I loved the word agnostic, and I was really impressed that you guys used it. And someone was like, really, there's a chapter in here for you. And I read We Agnostics. No, actually, that was a little later, though, after I got willing. But I started to learn about alcoholism and what alcoholism was, and that was really important. And people didn't just shove a big book at me because I wouldn't have done that very well. You know, I couldn't have just gone to a book. But people talked about what alcoholism was. You know, they talked about the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And I started to go, oh, wait, you know, maybe my drinking wasn't normal. Because it really hadn't occurred to me that it wasn't normal. It seems like it should have been really obvious that the way that I drank wasn't normal. But to me, that wasn't really obvious until people said it. I was like, really? Yeah, I guess, yeah, other people don't. Oh, yeah, I guess other people drove me home when I was like that. Yeah, okay, right. You know, like, I would go to bars and, like, scam drinks off of old men because it was really easy then, you know. But other people had to come in and save me. Like, other people were sober enough when we would go out drinking that they would take care of me, and it just never occurred to me that they weren't as drunk as I was. So things like that started to click together, and things like realizing who I'd been when I was 12 and who I was now and the things that I wanted, you know, and how every year it got worse. Every year, I drank more. You know, every year, there was more consequences. Like, that just had never, I had never noticed, you know. Like I said, the frog in the boiling pot. Like, I never noticed. And then I went, holy smokes. And it was the first time I kind of thought, like, I'm being outsmarted by my own weird, diseased brain. Like, that's really weird that this stuff's going on, and I don't remember making these conscious decisions. So I started to logically put together, like, maybe I am an alcoholic. Maybe there is something to this. Maybe I do have a drinking problem, you know. And it was great that I was around young people because I couldn't get the whole, like, unmanageability thing, you know. Like, I would get stuck on stuff. I want to be like, my life's not unmanageable. Like, I live at home. I have food in the fridge. Like, everything's really cool, you know. And then people would be like, the only parts of your life that are manageable are the parts that other people are managing for you. Everything that you are responsible for is, like, utter crap. And I had to kind of look at that. Okay, like, roof over my head and the food. Okay, obviously, Dad. what am I responsible for? Okay, school, which I was pretending to go to. And I had already been fired from a job. I worked at a place called Snack Time at Northlake Mall. And I got fired because we were allowed to eat the food there. Like, that wasn't a big deal. But, like, I came in one Friday night, and I was on, like, another substance. And it just became really obvious because I ate a lot. Because they had, like, nachos and hot dogs. And, yeah, so anyway, so it was a total bust. And they were like, yeah, you're fired. So I'd already lost a job. And, like, obviously my relationship with my mom and my relationship with a whole lot of other people, you know, everything that I was responsible for was completely unmanageable. And I was like, oh, that had never occurred to me before. Oh. So I started to get all that, but I still just wasn't willing. But I hung around. I hung around. And people let me hang around. And by the time I got about 4 months sober, I started getting really uncomfortable. You know, like I said, I totally think that I was an alcoholic long before I ever picked up a drink. I was uncomfortable in my own skin. And that when I drank alcohol, somehow my skin fit. Something about that made my skin fit. It caused lots of other problems, but somehow it made my skin fit. So when I take alcohol away and I don't do anything different, my skin starts to get really uncomfortable again. And like that's exactly what happened, is I started to get really uncomfortable. And it all just kind of escalated into one night when I had about 4 months. And I just remember I was sitting in my driveway with my boyfriend, and I'm bawling. I'm just bawling. And I just, people talked about like the big hole in your gut that you feel like the wind can blow through. Like I was feeling all that. I felt empty and alone and crazy and weird, and I'm sobbing. And I'm just going, and there's nothing wrong. Like nothing had happened that night to like cause this kind of emotion. Like I just had a freaking meltdown. And I'm like rocking back and forth, and I just want to go home. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. And those are like the only words I knew to put on it. And I was in my driveway, you know, but I just want to go home. I just want to go home. And so that night was the night where I went, you know what, I've got to do something different, you know, because either I'm going to drink, I'm going to off myself, or maybe before I do that, I'll start doing all that stupid crap that you people have been telling me to do, which is about as enthusiastic as I was about it. So I was finally willing. I picked up the phone and called, you know, my sponsor person, you know, who I really hadn't called before, and was like, okay, I'm willing. And she was like, great, you know, and started to tell me to do a bunch of stuff right away. And, you know, I was supposed to call like 3 girls a day, which, oh, God, I hate it. And going to meetings to do all this. And she's like, you know, and I want you to start praying. And I'm like, ha. And I'm like, I don't, and then I felt jammed because by this point, this was my window of willingness, you know. And I was, okay, I'm willing, but I did not know how to get from where I was to where you were. Like, cute that you guys all believed in stuff, but I didn't know how to make that leap, and I didn't know how to get there. And I was just, went here, you know, I'm struggling, and I'm trying to think, and I'm like, is there a religion that I can pick, but I have problems with all of them, and blah, 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 you know, and I thought that was kind of what I had to do, was, like, figure it out. Like, if I could pick a religion or figure it out and swallow it whole, then I could believe. And she was like, dude, just calm down. She's like, just start praying. She's like, and start with what you believe, even if it's almost nothing, just what you believe. Don't worry. She said, quit worrying about what you don't believe. Best words anybody ever said to me. Quit worrying about what you don't believe and just worry about what you do believe, even if it's almost nothing. And I was like, okay, because it was like, okay, I kind of believe that you guys got something, that there's something that happens there, but I have no idea what it is. And okay, she said, great. So she told me to get on my knees to pray. And I was like, oh, fine. So when I prayed, it was like this very undramatic thing that I did. You know, I was like in my room at home, and it was at night, and I was like, oh, fine. I closed the door because, heaven forbid, my father, who's a minister, would come and walk in on me praying. Like, that would have been horrific somehow. So I closed the door. I'm all weird and embarrassed about it, and then I'm like, okay. And then, like, I get on my knees, and I'm like, and people had said, you know, just talk to God or whatever, like how you would talk to, like, your buddy or something. I'm like, all right, well, fine. So I'm like, okay, dude, like, whatever you are, I need to know more about you. I need some help. I need to like connect with something. Okay. And I really felt like an idiot. I felt like I was talking to the air. Like this felt like the dumbest thing I've ever done in my entire life. And then I'm like, you know, but I called my sponsor and I'm like, okay, I did it. Okay, good. Do it again in the morning. And what I think is so funny looking back was, you know, it felt so unmonumental. It felt so like nothing dramatic happened. You know, I thought like when I finally surrendered, the sky was going to open up, birds were going to sing or something crazy like that. And it was so undramatic, you know, but I did. I did it the next day, and I did it the next day, and I did it the next day. And it was like somewhere in there, like stuff started to make sense. Like things that you people talked about in meetings started to make sense. Like those weird little like gotchas that you guys would talk about, you know, little weird coincidences, things like that would start to happen. You know, I started, like something started to happen. But it was not big and dramatic. It was like slow and quiet, you know. And it seems like that's how like most of the stuff that is really awesome in my life, like how that happens, is just this nice slow and quiet. So, I mean, kind of like the frog in the boiling pot, you know, like on the other end, you know, spiritually, kind of like that too. Like, not a whole lot. It was like creeping in. And then, like, before I knew it was like there was something about how I operated that was spiritual, you know, that I started to have more of that conscious contact, you know. I went on to, like, work the rest of the steps and clean house, you know, and, like, did an inventory and, like, made some amends and, you know, and things started to change. My life started to change. My skin started to fit. Like, somewhere in there, my skin started to fit. And what I learned, what I had, was a design for living, you know. And it was funny. You know what's really funny is I went to those meetings, and I hated AA meetings for a really long time. We would go in hordes to, like, you know, grown-up regular AA meetings. And it was so funny. It always sounded like peanuts to me, like rah, rah, rah. And it wasn't until I had a year sober that I remember sitting at, like, you know, 8111 or something, you know, where we'd randomly drop in, and it really clicked, like, oh my God, they're talking about the same stuff we are. Like, it really took me that long. I don't know why. It was like I had some kind of weird, like, young people impairment. I don't know. Like, oh my God, they're actually talking about the same stuff that we are. And it was awesome. So what's funny now, right, is, okay, so I've sobered up, and then I had to, like, continue growing up, and, like, I've now been sober for, like, it hurts my head, 23 years. It'll be, like, in May, God willing, like, it'll be 24. Isn't that crazy? Like, after a while, it just sounds old. It really does. It sounds really old and weird. But what I've had since then is, like, the opportunity to live my life. I have a groundwork. And I've done a lot of crazy stuff since. I went on to, like, work for a drug and alcohol program for, like, 10 years, for the next 10 years, which was really kind of fun, you know, and I got to travel around a lot, and I was in my 20s, and it was cool, and, like, I got married, and I was married for 7 years, and then I got divorced, and that was, like, a whole weird, you know, like, spiritual lesson in and of itself, And there were times when I worked an awesome program, and there were times when my program really kind of sucked, and there were times when, you know, I kind of, like, hit these, like, emotional bottoms and have to, like, go back to the basics and, like, get it right. And but you know what? AA is the great, like, leveler touch to, I don't know what to call it, but it was, like, anything, and even when I would screw up, it was, like, how awesome that, like, I have these simple things to come back to. I heard somebody say in a meeting, like, a long time ago, they were saying that, like, after a while, like, working a program is kind of like, I guess, pilots, like, flying a plane. And I did not know this, really, or I guess I just never thought about it. But, like, planes, when they're going somewhere, like, are never really, like, 100% on course. Like, there's always some, like, little level of correcting that's happening, right? So I'm always going to be correcting, and I always have been correcting. But now, like, there have been times when my corrections are much more, like, crazy severe, and obviously if I stay in one direction or the other long enough, like, we're in some serious trouble. But it's so awesome that I have a way to correct, and that I have a means to correct, you know, and when the program is my priority, you know, when I'm in the middle of the bed of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I always can be corrected, you know. I have a sponsor. I'm honest with my sponsor. I work the steps, and I'm of service, and I go to meetings. And all of these are ways for me to check in. Like, when I go to a meeting, like, it may not be anything that's even talked about in the meeting, but, like, I walk into a meeting and there's something about me that just gets checked. You know, whether it's I notice I'm really self-centered because I'm not paying any attention to the newcomer in the corner, or, you know, or I feel awkward, or I feel like my skin does fit. Something about, there's some kind of correcting that just happens when I walk into a meeting, you know, or I see my friends, you know. And I have a home group, and I have people who know me. You know, my home group is Rule 62 down the street at 8111. And you know, people know if I'm not okay. Why? Because I have let people get to know me, and they know if I'm not okay. Like, how awesome is that? and having a sponsor. And I've learned the hard way that, like, not being entirely honest is a very bad idea. In the beginning, it was like, you know, somewhere in their growth, right, I think it's just different levels of honesty. Every year, I feel like I'll pick up a chip, and I'll be like, oh, this year, like, I totally understand what being honest is, because, like, last year, I had no idea, you know? But it feels like that every year. Like, I have reached this new level of honesty. Like, God, I was so full of it last year. You know, or, like, turning my will and my life over to God. Like, this year, I really get what, like, surrender and living in God's will is about, and I totally didn't get it last year. Oh, my God, I was, like, so stupid last year. But I figure as long as, like, that happens, like, I'm continuing to grow and change. Like, how cool, you know? And if I'm continuing to grow and change, then I'm walking into meetings, and, like, you know what? I'm serious. Like, after 23 whatever years, I'm hearing the same crap in meetings all the time. I mean, you may hear it in, like, fancier different ways, different voices, but really it's the same stuff over and over again. That's just how it is. But when I'm growing spiritually, I hear it differently, you know? Because if I'm, like, if I'm married, I'm learning how to take risks and, like, you know, have a new level of responsibility with my husband or something like that, and I walk into a meeting and they're talking about living in God's will, like, I'm hearing it with different ears because this part of my life is, like, opened up to that in a different way. You know, I'm hearing it differently, you know, or anything like that, you know. As long as I'm growing and changing, I'm always going to hear it. So what's totally a red flag for me is if I walk into a meeting and I'm like, I feel like I've totally heard it before, and it feels stale and boring. Heads up, every meeting is in some ways kind of stale and boring. I'm the one who has to be fresh and different. So that is my red flag. If I feel bored, whatever, they say the same thing all the time, they're going to do it. They're going to continue to do it. I have to be different, you know. And it's when I'm in that place, like, my life is always an amazing adventure. It's always good. I know, Paul, I know. You know what's hilarious, right? Like, I asked, like, so what time do I need to end? And Jerry was kind of like, you know, whatever, you know, content, whatever, you know, take as long as you need to tell the story. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, my husband has a short attention span. I have a short attention span, so I have a great appreciation for short attention spans. My husband's brain will, like, literally, like, shut off at a certain point. Like, if there's a speaker and they go after a certain point, he's done. He's not listening. He's like, you know, and same thing, like, in a regular discussion meeting, and I get this, like, my brain, if you share longer than 3 minutes, my brain completely turns off, and I cannot hear anything you say after that. I'm done. Done. You may have something wonderful to say, but it doesn't matter. So anyway, but that's, I mean, I get to use these tools, the same tools that I was handed when I got here, in, like, all these amazing different parts of my life today, and that includes in my marriage with my husband, who has a short attention span. And, like, next week, my dad had a stroke last year. And my dad lives in Oregon, which, by the way, is an awesome place, but when your dad has a stroke, is, like, so far away. It's not even funny. I was really blessed last year that I was able to go and spend, like, a long time. It was almost 2 weeks with him while he was in inpatient rehab, and I stayed with him at the hospital. And it was, like, the craziest, hugest gift I ever could have had, especially because, seriously, like, you heard my story, how crazy. And this year, my dad is a lot better. He's a lot better. He still can't stay by himself. Like, he's not, like, completely functional. But he's, like, awesome, you know. And he goes on walks, and he can talk and all that kind of stuff. He just can't, like, cook for himself and stuff. So my stepmom has to go have a surgery. And my brother and I get to, like, go take care of my dad for, like, 10 days. What a cool honor that is today. You know, and then I'm stoked. Like, I'm really stoked to, like, my brother lives in New York, so I don't even get to hang out with him that much. So my brother and I are going to go hang out in Oregon, and I get to hang out with my brother for a week, and, like, we get to take care of my dad for a week. And my dad is excited to have us there. My dad would not want anyone else there to hang out with him and take care of him. Like, how awesome is that? At least to me, I think that's, like, so cool. That I'm excited about doing it is a miracle, and that my dad wants me there, and everybody feels safe that I'm going to be the one, like, hanging out there. Like, what an amazing opportunity and a miracle that is. And, like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, I get to do today. So I'm going to shut up now. But, man, middle of the bed day service, these are all good things. I could go on forever, but I won't, because some of you will stop listening just like my husband. So thank you so much for having me tonight. I really appreciate it.